This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Today is Tuesday, July 26, 2016. I am your host, Sophia Ray. Tune in to The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 p.m. Pacific Time for interview-style talk radio with various hosts. The People Speak would like to hear your voice. United States and Canadian callers may participate by calling in during the show toll-free at 1-888-429-5471. Again, that number is 1-888-429-5471. For more information about The People Speak and future guests, log on to bbsradio.com. Our guest is Andrew Bisago, a lawyer in private practice out of Washington State and the presidential candidate for the Independent Party for the elections of 2016 this November. Although some of you may have never heard of him, Cliffs High Webbot predicted Andrew's presidency, but it's not said when. Andy served in Project Pegasus as a child chrononaut at the dawn of time-space age and one of humanity's early Mars explorers. Get this, with Barry Satoru. He traveled to Mars with Barry Satoru, the chief of commander now known as Barack Obama. Andy is a prominent figure in the truth movement, leading a campaign to lobby the U.S. government to disclose such truth as the fact that the U.S. achieved quantum access to future and past events and has time traveled to a place, a secret U.S. presence on Mars. Excuse me, I'm kind of nervous. Time travel? We'll have to ask Andy himself. Andy, thank you for being on The People Speak, and welcome.
Thank you for having me, Sophia. You know, when you introduced me and I realized how time travel is viewed as such a, you know, a tall drink of water for most Americans, the truth of the situation is that I first teleported via technology that had already been developed by DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, 48 years ago. I'm 54. I first teleported with my father from a Tesla teleport at the old Curtiss Wright Aeronautical Company in Wood Ridge, New Jersey, to the Santa Fe, the New Mexico State Capitol grounds in Santa Fe. I will mark the anniversary, the 50th anniversary of that in 2018. So this gives, I'm just giving your listeners a sense of how out of alignment we are with our own history. The true technical history of our great country was secreted. In other words, the truth of our technical history has been concealed by our government, so that when we talk about things that were developed a half century ago, they seem like science fiction. And I just thought I would share that observation at the top of our interview tonight.
So how is, you know, as a whole, collective humanity, with the government, you know, working with their people and giving their people correct information, you know, how can we catch up?
We have to disseminate the idea, and I've been working on this for years, but we have to alert the public to the notion that the United States government has had trillions of dollars, 70 years, some of the most brilliant physicists and electrical engineers of our global civilization, conditions of absolute secrecy in which the project participants even agreed to be assassinated if they violated their security oaths, and large military reservations in Nevada, in New Mexico, to carry out all manner of technical experimentation, and basically to propagate the idea, in fact, that science fiction was introduced as a literary genre to mask the secret defense work that was ongoing. As an example, Robert Heinlein and Arthur C. Clarke had desks next to each other at British intelligence during the war. So we have to reclaim our history by propagating the truth that science fiction has actually been disseminating altered descriptions of things that have actually been accomplished secretly by our government. And I've been working on it. It just takes time. You know, I think now about we estimate that 250 million viewers and listeners have learned about some aspect of my secret project experiences, and it's just going to be a matter of more whistleblowers coming forward. I've brought three fellow Mars visitors forward, including a career Army officer, William Whitecrow, just recently. And in a few weeks, I'll be bringing forward one of my fellow teleportees from Project Pegasus, who I grew up with, who I went to the same school with, who indeed I even went to church with, you know, the same Catholic parish. So it's just a matter of bringing the truth forward, and those of us who have had this secret experience to stand in our truth. You know, I've taken my truth campaign all the way into a run for the presidency, and the truth is the truth. Scripture states that ultimately we shall know the truth and it shall set us free, and we have to stand in our truth and not allow ourselves to be intimidated by the very superficial, sarcastic approach that suggests this kind of material or these kind of claims are farcical or stupid or ridiculous or so far out there they can't be believed. Because in fact, with the trillions of dollars of primarily secret corporate money, not public money, that our government has had, when I was serving in Project Pegasus almost 50 years ago, they were already talking about how their present technology was 200 years in advance of what the public could imagine. So we just have to readjust and get over the cognitive dissonance of the fact that, you know, building more destructive nuclear weapons is not all that our Defense Department has been working on for the last 70 years. As Ben Rich of Lockheed, the late CEO of Lockheed Skunk Works, stated several years before his death, several years ago, he said, anything you imagine that we can accomplish, we have accomplished. And this is a direct quote from the chairman of Lockheed. He said, we now have the technology to take ET home. Implying that American astronauts have left the solar system. So we just have to witness what the truth tellers are saying, those who are coming forward, who are credible, who are consistent in their facts, who are doing what I'm doing by naming names, describing project locations, the corporations that were involved, the U.S. agencies that were involved, the names of the physicists and engineers who were attached to these projects, and then bring forward some of the mid-career professionals who were involved 30 and 40 years ago, some of the children of my generation who were involved, so that the public comes to understand that this is not some elaborate joke. This is actually the true history of our country.
How old were you when you were chosen for the secret space programs, and why were you chosen?
It's a pretty complex question. I first teleported at age 6 in winter of 1968, and then in the fall of 1969, as I entered my third grade year, I was September. I beg your pardon?
You teleported to where your first time?
The first time I teleported from Woodridge, New Jersey to Santa Fe, New Mexico via a Tesla teleporter that was at the Curtis Wright Aeronautical Company facility in Woodridge, New Jersey. That was a defense location. It was where our strategic bombers were built during World War II, and there were many numbered buildings where different technical projects were ongoing. And in Building 68, they had prototyped a device that they found in Nikola Tesla's papers. He had just labeled it energetic array. And they prototyped it and turned it on. And one day, one of the technicians on the project walked through the energy field that these two parentheses-shaped booms were broadcasting between themselves on the shop floor to retrieve a screwdriver across the shop. And he tumbled through a vortal tunnel to Africa, and it took him 6 weeks to find his way home. So they sort of accidentally discovered that this energetic array that Tesla had modeled was deriving a form of energy from the universe itself that Tesla called radiant energy, that among its natural, inherent capabilities is the capacity to bend the fabric of time-space. So when we took a run at that energy field, a tunnel opened up in time-space, and we saw a tiny pinprick of light in the distance, and then the light grew closer, and wherever the tunnel closed, that's where we had been repositioned on the surface of the Earth. However, by the fall of 1970, when I was serving on the project, my third, fourth, and fifth grade year, in fall of 1970, when we would jump back from New Mexico to New Jersey, we noticed that night had already fallen in New Mexico, but it was back around 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning of the same day in New Jersey. And we would just be driven by school bus back to our school and complete the school day and then walk home. And we said to the technicians there at Curtis Wright, you're time traveling us, aren't you? You're setting us back in time. And they sheepishly acknowledged that they were. And then we asked them, how long can you put us back in time? And they said, right now, 12 hours. Okay, and they did that by adjusting the Tesla teleporter so that the teleportee arrived in what we call the past or future. In other words, they made an adjustment to the teleportation device so that they literally began involving adults and children in moving us around in terms of our position in time-space. In other words, time traveling.
Now, this was through Project Pegasus, and I'm not sure how many of our listeners are aware of this Project Pegasus. Can you give them more insight about it?
Well, Project Pegasus was what the children were told that the project descriptor was. We had a lecture at an Army base near Morristown, New Jersey. I believe it was the Morristown Army Arsenal. The word ARPA was written on the board because originally DARPA, of course, was just the Advanced Research Projects Agency, and then it became the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And they explained how the project that we were on would involve technologies that would allow us to sort of jump over the rainbow. In other words, we would be teleporting across the country and back. We would be doing things that seemed fantastic. So they had decided to name it Pegasus, I guess after the mythological Pegasus flight to Mount Olympus, not over the rainbow, but to the summit of Mount Olympus in Greek mythology. And what it was a classified defense-related research and development program in which the United States government was putting everything it could gather that would give the U.S. intelligence community what I call a quantum access capability. In other words, the ability to send people to past and future events or to model real-time holograms of past and future events so that information could be gathered about the past and future. And so during the time that I served on Project Pegasus, I was involved in everything from conventional remote viewing for the Office of Naval Intelligence all the way through to several forms of physical time travel. And that's really the import of my account, is that while after the war they decided to publicly acknowledge, indeed trumpet, their advances in things like the destructiveness of nuclear weapons, the same atomic physicists who had built the atomic bomb, men like Dr. Harold Agnew and Dr. Edward Teller, were secretly working on time travel. And Project Pegasus was essentially the secret twin of Project Manhattan. I interacted with many of the Manhattan Project physicists when I was on Project Pegasus. An example would be one day I was standing in one of the hallways at the Los Alamos National Laboratories, and my father was conversing with Emilio Segre, one of the Italian physicists on the Manhattan Project, explaining to him that we were in New Mexico on a teleportation project. So I believe the public deserves to know that in 1970, right, the very year that Earth Day was initiated, the very year when the E environmental symbol was developed, and we sort of marked our emergent environmental consciousness, secretly within the secret reaches of the U.S. defense community, a technology was being developed that if we used it to eliminate all forms of transport that rely on the internal combustion engine, just doing that will remove 60%, that's 60% of the greenhouse gases that are emitted from human activities. So I'm very evangelistic about urging people to find out what Project Pegasus was and what it accomplished, because we're going to be needing this teleportation technology to literally stem climate change, the very global warming problem that could lead, for example, to the advent of a new ice age, as depicted by Art Bell and Whitley Strieber in their brilliant work, The Coming Global Superstorm. So I'm essentially continuing to work in this area, as I did in childhood, to alert the public that, look, we've got a profound solution here, and we have to demand from our government that they declassify and deploy this teleportation technology, because utilizing it, we will essentially achieve a greater than half solution to climate change.
You know, I want to know, since you said evangelicist, are you familiar with Paul Hellyer? He was a previous guest on here, former weapons or Minister of Defense for Canada. You know, he's a whistleblower on the government meeting with dozens of species of aliens. What are your thoughts on it? Have you met any interdimensional species, aliens, whatever these beings are called? You know, our viewers are interested.
Well, that's a very interesting and apropos question, because, in fact, I had publicly described in public lectures and public radio broadcasts how in my 1970-71 school year, which for me was the fourth grade, I was present at a lecture in which it was explained to us as children in the program that the U.S. government knew that approximately 70 different species of extraterrestrials had visited Earth, but that four were visiting Earth most frequently, or frequently at all. And they were the tall grays, the small grays, the reptilians, and the Nordics. And I later learned that in the Honorable Paul T. Hellyer's whistleblower testimony, as really one of the only individuals with cabinet-level authority in the area of defense or intelligence or military affairs, as the former defense minister for Canada, had also described in his public talks and media interviews that he received the same briefing. So there is a point of correspondence between our whistleblowing, in the sense that Secretary or Minister Hellyer and I have described how in that 1970-71 time frame, the leading governments of the world, including the United States and obviously Canada, were aware of the fact that we are being visited frequently by four specific species of ETs. Now, in terms of my personal contact with ETs, it's a little bit of a mixed profile, so I'll try to describe what I think happened. I was time traveling in childhood, after having been born in 1961. But going back to the early 50s, my father had worked on a number of the classified jet aircraft programs, for example, the development of the ramjet, to chase the ETs out of our atmosphere and away from our planet. For example, my dad designed the metal alloy by which the ramjet would be built. He worked on the instrumentation for the B-70, which was going to be the strategic bomber that wouldn't have to land because it would be powered by an atomic power source. That was the so-called Flying Chernobyl that never got built. But nonetheless, he was brought into defense activities after the famous July 1952 overflight of our nation's capital by nine extraterrestrial craft that were clocked on radar at Langley Air Force Base in Virginia as traveling at 7,000 miles per hour and winking out in one area of the sky above the Capitol and then reappearing instantaneously in another location, indicating that they were teleporting or time traveling above the Capitol. So my dad, who had been working in a conventional engineering position at Okanite Company in Paramus, New Jersey, was suddenly called into that secret defense realm where we were working on technologies to cope or potentially cope with the extraterrestrial presence. And he remained in that capacity with the Ralph M. Parsons Company, prominent engineering firm and defense contractor, until his retirement in 1984. So growing up in a household where my father was working on these most advanced defense projects to deal with the extraterrestrial presence, at least to chase them out of our atmosphere as potentially hostile visitors, even though we weren't sure that they were hostile. I was having frequent contact with the small grays. In fact, when I attended that talk where they showed us very exquisite drawings of the four types of ETs that are visiting our planet frequently, the instructor said many of you children have already had contact with this type, the small grays, because we had been interviewed back in kindergarten by two FBI agents about the contacts we were having in the neighborhood, in our homes, nocturnally and so forth, in sort of the classic alien contact scenario by the small grays. And I also learned during my schooling in Project Pegasus that the Defense Department knew by 1971-72 that it was the small grays who assisted humanity in uplifting ourselves following the solar system catastrophe of 11,500 years ago that eclipsed that first civilization on Earth, the great maritime civilization that had built the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx. So 6,000 years later, approximately, we were lectured in how the small grays had intervened in ancient Sumer, and they gave humanity mathematics and literature and writing and so forth so that we could develop ourselves back into a planetary civilization, which we've now done. But the other thing I learned, in addition to that relatively unknown fact that it was purposeful intervention by the grays that allowed us to become basically a technical civilization again after that first technical civilization had been eclipsed by a natural event in our solar system, that they knew by 1972, and I got this in a one-on-one meeting with one of the project educators, that the gray ETs have been contacting people for several hundred years. The U.S. government knew that specific people are being contacted, that there was one of the known characteristics of those contacts were enhancements in things like intelligence and creativity and technical ability, and that such individuals could be expected to be contacted throughout their lifespans. So, yes, I was very much the son of a Defense Department engineer of that era who was growing up in a household, you know, with posters of the NASA astronauts on my bedroom wall. But I was also having contact with the grays that were prompted either by my father's classified defense work or by what I was brought into by him in the realm of time travel. I think probably both.
For those who are now just tuning in to The People Speak, I am Sophia Ray, your host, here with Andrew Basago, who is talking about his child years as a chrononaut, if I may use that word. Chrononaut meaning time traveler. You know, let's take this moment to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. Stay tuned to The People Speak.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Today's school libraries are filled with endless opportunities. With access to print and digital materials, the latest technologies, and the guidance of a school librarian, our children are empowered with the tools they need to succeed in school and beyond. I'm Julianne Moore. Join me in celebrating all of the ways that school libraries and librarians are transforming learning for our students. For more information on how you can become involved, visit the American Association of School Librarians at aasl.org.
This land as your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
And we are back live on The People Speak. Your host, Sophia Ray, and we are here with Andrew Basago. Oh, my gosh. Why am I doing this right now? I missed your name. We have a caller in the line. Let's just get the caller in. Caller, where are you calling from? And your question. Your name, too.
Yeah, this is Ken from, I'm in Jacksonville, Florida. Question has to do with what the show's been talking about, what you've been talking about here about aliens. And my question is, do you have any evidence that the Vatican is aware of what's going on and that the Vatican is hiding this?
I do, in fact, Ken. What I learned when I was serving in Project Pegasus is that the Vatican commissions many of these advanced technical projects, and they're basically assigned to a specific agency, like, for example, the U.S. Navy or a DARPA and a defense contractor like Parsons. Now, the way I think we can conceptualize this is that the Vatican, essentially, the priesthood underneath the Vatican was, in a sense, the rudimentary intelligence agency of the world, because Catholic priests were deployed in many countries, and they were utilizing the confessional to extract intelligence down to the household level. Okay, so in a sense, I'm sure that a more gifted historian than I could literally track the connection between the priesthood and the CIA. But I don't think it's an accident that there was a Mormon and a Catholic faction inside the CIA after it was founded after World War II, because in fact, I think the way to look at the Catholic priesthood is as the original CIA. I know that the Mafia was, I learned from somebody at CIA that the Mafia was created with its paramount goal being to protect the papacy. We know that the Vatican Library beneath Rome goes on for miles. We know that the Vatican has been building astronomical observatories to derive intelligence about off-planet affairs. So I think the way that we should look at the Vatican is sort of almost as the super agency above the intelligence agencies, and an older one at that, because of the network of priests that for centuries have been gathering intelligence, not just at the neighborhood level or parish level, but down to the household level, to people's personal secrets based on what they've confessed in the confessional.
Oh, okay. Well, that's I read this book for I forgot who wrote it. His name was Ray someone. He was in my hometown and he wrote this book, and I picked this book up, and he spoke about it a little bit. I'm trying to collect my sources here. I appreciate the answer, the question there.
Thank you for calling
in. Very much.
Yeah. For example, Ken, if I just might follow up, the Chronovisor was developed at the Catholic University of Milan by two Vatican musicologists named Pellegrino Ernetti and Agostino Gemelli. And that technology was passed on by the Vatican to DARPA. So there was a direct Vatican input, I should add, into time travel. Into U.S. time travel.
Let's get into more questions here, Andrew. And I have one coming in from Mike from out of California. He says, Andrew, a recent past guest was Professor Guy McPherson, who said we are in a mass extinction crisis. There is no hope. Will E.T. intervene and save us? That's quite a question.
Well, I don't know if it'll save us, but I mean, we know that the ETs have been involved in harvesting of genetic material, presumably to hybridize new life forms on other planets in which our genetic lineage is part of the input. So I would say that if we look at the broad scope of ET interaction with the human race, I can certainly reliably cite Dr. Michael Sala, who has observed that even though the vast majority of that contact has been benign, the ETs have traditionally used a lot of stealth. That was Michael's observation. And I think that's pertinent. So in terms of them, there seems to have been a history of them honoring what emerged on Star Trek, you know, in entertainment, but still has an intellectual currency to it. And that is the notion of the prime directive, where you don't want to intervene in the emergence of a civilization, because then you unnaturally influence its evolution. So I think that if we look at the stealth and the efforts that the ETs have made, for example, to block people's memories of their contacts, it would seem like they're performing certain custodial functions, even genetic custodial functions in relation to us, but also trying to keep sort of at arm's length from us so that they don't intervene in our evolution. So my guess is that they would stand back and allow us to destroy ourselves if we're going to do so as a result of our genetic inadequacies.
It sounds like some huge test, you know, for humanity, and they're just going to stand by and watch us destroy ourselves. You know, Andrew, I want to talk about you as president. That's going to, when did you decide to run for president?
Actually, I was narrating on Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie, to George, on November 10th of 2011, about the fact that when I was serving in the Mars Jump Room program, my same age colleague Barry Satoru and I were openly being discussed as future presidents by my father and Thomas Stillings and Barry Satoru's mother, Stanley Ann Dunham, and other CIA people, adults, mid-career professionals, as it were, who were attending the lectures.
Really quick, I don't want to cut you off, but this sounds like an Ayn Rand book, Atlas Shrugged. Does that seem familiar to you?
I served gasoline to Ayn Rand at an Exxon station that once existed in Chatsworth, California, where she had a home going back to the 1940s. She had one of Richard Neutra's homes that had been built in Chatsworth, California. So I met Ayn Rand and had a brief philosophical discussion with her. But I haven't read The Fountainhead or Atlas Shrugged, so I can't attribute that to her books.
It's about, I believe, a colored guy, meaning a black African-American, and a Caucasian white guy who are groomed, they're brothers in some way, but I don't remember how. It's been a while. And they are groomed to be presidents of the United States. And you said you were in jump rooms with Barry Satoru, now Barack Obama, and you time traveled with him. Has he ever, as president, acknowledged this?
Well, let me in prescript, let me say that what you just shared with me is astonishing, because Ayn Rand knew Courtney M. Hunt, who was my second Mars training officer, who was career CIA. And in fact, I had discussions with Hunt about Satoru, who we now know as Barack Obama. So let me describe now. So that's very curious. You've given me a lead there that I want to track down now, because perhaps that theme entered Ayn Rand's novel as a result of her being informed by CIA that a Caucasian and African-American future president would be put together as brothers, and speaking metaphorically, in something special, because we were. I was trained with Barack Obama. I roomed with him for several days until a room was provided for me. We were in seclusion with Regina Dugan for several months at College of the Siskiyous in Weed, California, working on our thesis for the CIA's threat assessment regarding the human civilization on Mars. We were analyzing 4 inches of documents about the Martian humanoid civilization provided to the CIA by the French intelligence agency. And my French was only passable at that point. I understood about 25% of those documents. I think Regina wrote a much more impressive thesis, and I never really discerned the French language abilities of Barry. But I got to know him very well. I would sometimes see him at the jump room facility in El Segundo near the Los Angeles airport. I sometimes mm-hmm. jumped with him, and I was in several sort of scientific type jumps with him under the tutelage or direction of Bernard Mendez, who was one of the whistleblowers who has stepped forward. Now, when we when William Stillings and Laura Eisenhower, the great-granddaughter of President Eisenhower, stepped forward on that show, that was the same show where I declared my ultimate decision to run for president in 2016 as the mm-hmm. truth candidate, we revealed the fact, that Barack Obama was one of the Mars jumpers. We had to, because if we denied the truth that he was, people would later say, well, you were engaged in some kind of controlled release of information, you know, in the terminology of Watergate, a public limited hangout of what had happened and what CIA had done during those years. So we were really between a rock and a hard place in the sense that if we denied that Obama was one of the jumpers so that we wouldn't include that strange element in our account, then later we could be accused of holding back information. On the other hand, if we told the truth and revealed that he was one of the Mars jumpers, then we would be accused of telling an even stranger story. And we would give grist to the cynics and the critics and the skeptics and the lampooners. And that's what happened. But he was one of the jumpers. His mm-hmm. mother or adoptive mother, Stanley Ann Dunham, was at most of the lectures. In fact, she gave an excellent 2 or 3 hour lecture one afternoon on cross-cultural communication in the event that we had interactions with intelligent humanoids on Mars and how to kind of control those interactions so that they worked out for the best. Now, when we revealed in November of, November of 2011 that he was one of the Mars jumpers, the White House did something unprecedented. Even though they could have dismissed our claims as resulting from conspiracy theory or an urban legend of some kind, the White House had the spokesperson for the National Security Council, a former Obama administration official by the name of Tommy Vitor, who had been his point man, in fact, on the certificate of live birth controversy, plant a story in Wired.com, the Wired magazine online, the version of Wired magazine, the magazine of the digital age, essentially, online, in which they ridiculed the concept that Obama had anything to do with Mars. Now imagine that. That was the spokesperson for the NSC. And that means that the decision to lampoon our claims was arrived at in some kind of consultative process involving the president, the vice president, the secretaries of state and defense, the national security advisor, the assistant national security advisor, and their spokesperson, Tommy Vitor, because that was a national security council press release, basically, planted in Wired.com. So I believe that that was in the nature of sort of a reverse tacit admission. In other words, by denying the truth of what we were saying, I think the Obama administration tripped on its own feet and ended up actually affirming what we were saying by denying it.
Now, are you familiar with Cliff High in his web bot?
Yes. In fact, the story there is that going back to 2009, Cliff identified me as a planetary-level whistleblower.
Explain and, that. Can you? What is a planetary whistleblower?
He uses a form of asymmetrical language processing. He basically takes the content of the World Wide Web, and he's identified about 300,000 words and concepts, and he utilizes a vast search engine to put them in order of their frequency online, mm-hmm. and then he goes through them and he analyzes them to try to see what story they're telling. And the particular mm-hmm. story that he kept on picking up was that somebody was going to publish something about space animals, and in fact it was my paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars, published on December 12th of 08, that Cliff determined was what he was picking up, that there was now enough data on Earth, and people were chatting about it, of life on Mars for somebody to come along and do what I did, which is analyze a single photograph of Mars that was NASA imaged, NASA JPL imaged, 10214. And in that image, I found multiple images of humanoids and animals, and also statues and structures showing both ancient life on Mars and contemporary life on Mars. So Cliff concluded that because his analysis of the World Wide Web was revealing that there was enough data to finally conclude that we were not alone in the universe, that when I came along and published that paper, I had earned the status, in his terminology, of a planetary level whistleblower.
Now, let's stand up on the track of presidency. You know, what are you going to do different, you know, with healthcare, with the economy, with education? What can you, so how are you going to utilize the space traveling inaugurate a utopia world? Is that what's going on here?
No. I've drafted my agenda. It's called 100 Proposals, A New Agenda for a New America. They are thoughtful distillations of my thinking in 100 different areas under the overarching rubrics of truth, reform, and innovation. There are 17 truth proposals, 53 reform proposals, and then 30 innovation proposals. So I would urge
your listeners. Do you have a website that they can read this on?
Yeah, those are at my campaign website, which is andy2016.com/proposals. Now, if you'd like me to answer in the specific areas you referenced, I would be happy to. You mentioned healthcare. I think there's no reason why we shouldn't join the other advanced industrialized democracies, including our neighbor Canada, and have a Canadian-styled single-payer healthcare program that covers everybody. And that's my position, and I'm tired of this equivocation within the Democratic Party. It was President Harry Truman, a Democrat, and President John F. Kennedy in one of his last speeches that called for what we now identify as, you know, a Canadian-styled single-payer healthcare system. So it's part of the what I call the true democracy, the true spirit of the Democratic Party, to call for that, not these equivocations that we've seen from Obama and from Hillary Clinton, you know, of Obamacare being partial coverage and penalizing people for not joining and so forth. We want to cover everybody, and we have an interest in doing that. There's a paradox in healthcare, which is you only can get, I mean, people frequently cost the healthcare system only by getting sick, but also by protecting everybody, we also protect ourselves from things like dread diseases and epidemics. So we're going to have to come to terms with the fact that in the area of healthcare, there is uniquely what I call a socialist impulse. In other words, it's one area where socialist thinking works because my neighbor's healthcare is my healthcare. And I know that some people resist that, and they believe that we can live in a country of rugged individualism, but not in the area of healthcare. Because, for example, if we allow people to not be treated for an epidemic disease, they can spread it to us. But then the paradox is that, for example, let's say in respiratory care, somebody who has been negligent with their health, whatever healthcare system you have, by smoking is going to cause more cost to the system. And these are just paradoxes of healthcare that we're going to have to accept and recognize that the most functional model, the model that two-thirds of Americans support, the model that works in other countries, is the Canadian-styled single-payer universal coverage of healthcare. Now, you mentioned some other areas, and
I mentioned education.
In education, I think that the principal thing that I'm concerned about is that the children coming of age today are learning in a fragmentary way as a result of the ubiquitous role in their lives that the internet is playing. It's affecting my life too. Rather than reading classical works of philosophy, great novels, great social novels, for example, or science publications and things that really educate and edify us, kids are being educated today online in a very fragmentary way. And what they don't know is astonishing. Like, for example, in this interview, I mentioned President Dwight Eisenhower, the commander of the Allied forces during World War II, and the president to soon follow Truman after the war, one of our most popular 20th century presidents. I dare say that most junior high school and high school students in the United States do not know who Dwight Eisenhower was. Why? Because they're getting this fragmentary learning online where they don't even know who John Kennedy or Ronald Reagan were. Okay, so what I'm calling for in education, it's not in one of my proposals, is I think we need consulting, not to invent ludicrous forms of education like Common Core. I want to see a return to classical readings. I believe that junior high and high school kids should be reading great novels. They should be viewing the great social justice movies of the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. Okay, so I guess what I'm saying here is I think we need counter education in the country to counteract the fragmentary impacts of the internet on today's American school children.
How about higher education in the depth that we are left into after graduation?
That is one of my proposals. I'm calling for an academic debt jubilee. Academic debt makes up 50% of our federal debt. And I know, again, there are Calvinist, you know, inspirited purists who believe that everybody should pay their debts. But in fact, education, like healthcare, is one of those unique human activities where the net benefits cannot be internalized by the individual. They are inherently externalized to the rest of society. That's another, a less complex and economically doctrinaire way of saying that would be to say that when one citizen is educated, society is improved. Okay, and obviously we want to educate everybody. So, for example, when one citizen goes to college, we're living in a better America because they're going to be disseminating that knowledge and acting on those techniques for the rest of their career, I dare say for the rest of their lives. Okay, that being the case, because the individual bears the burden of and internalizes the cost of education itself, they have to perform as a student to get their degree, to have a marketable degree in the job force. I believe we should forgive all academic debt, and the net benefit of that is rather than going statically being used to pay debt, that capital would be freed up to purchase goods and services in the economy, and that will result, the net result of that, with academic debt being so much of our debt, is that that will be an engine of our recovery from the extended recession that we've been in since 2007 and 8. The Obama years, as it were, has been 8 years of economic stagnation that arguably has actually been a depression, if you factor in the fact that in a depression, enterprises are failing, jobs are being lost or not replaced, and the average person has very little discretionary capital. Okay, so I favor an academic debt jubilee so that nth person who evinced the responsibility and the diligence to get educated and get their degree. That would be a qualification of getting your academic debt forgiven. You had to progress from your indebtedness into the status of a graduate of the program that you were pursuing. I would then forgive that debt so that capital would be freed up to be used as an engine of economic recovery in our country.
How about I got one more? And if you could just go through this one briefly since we're coming to the end of our show and hopefully I can get one more question into you. How about this religion?
Well, what I'm concerned about is the fact that the media is being used to portray all adherents to Islam as jihadists and terrorists. In fact, there are about a billion Muslims in the world. And those from the conservative to radical faction that even identify with using violence and jihad to advance Islam are about 200 million. So the other 90% of Islams believe that Islam is a religion of peace and act accordingly. So, for example, with the exception of a few high-profile shooting incidents like the one at Fort Hood in Texas involving Muslims, the Muslim population in the United States has in the main been incredibly law-abiding and peaceable. And my concern is just as with the hysteria of the Japanese internment during World War II, the government and political candidates like Donald Trump and the mainstream media is tending to create hysteria about the adherence to that particular religious faith, which I think is contrary to the spirit of pluralism and tolerance of other people's religion, that it's not just the American tradition, but it's embedded in our First Amendment, where the government can neither prohibit nor foster this, a state religion. And so, you know, prohibit religion, the free exercise of religion, or establish a religion. So in that sense, I think we have to step back and step back from the hysteria and recognize that just as with other groups from around the world, people shouldn't be disqualified from citizenship or harassed and persecuted while they're here because their adherence to Islam, because most adherents to Islam are just as peaceable as their agnostic and Jewish and Catholic and Protestant neighbors, or their Buddhists and Hindu friends down the street. We are a pluralistic society, and we should maintain that tradition and not debase ourselves by beginning to persecute adherents to the Muslim faith.
Very well, very well. We are coming down to the very last few minutes of our show, and I want to ask you this. Why should we vote for you?
Because I've served my country. I've served my country in two defense projects were some of the most advanced undertakings that have ever been undertaken by our country were undertaken. I served ably and well. I served bravely. I saved five human lives when I was in the Mars program in different incidents and some of the same incidents. I'm a highly educated man. I possess 6 degrees, including degrees in philosophy and history from Cambridge and UCLA. I've been practicing law with an entirely spotless record for 20 years in the state of Washington. And I'm a leader in the truth movement who has always told the truth to the American people. So if you want to see truth returned to the U.S. presidency, which I believe in its fullest expression we haven't seen since the administration of John F. Kennedy, then I'm your candidate.
Absolutely. Amen. Andrew, and here's another question. I'm just going to jump around a little bit, you know. Were you a member of Mensa, and if so, can you disclose your IQ to us?
Yes, I'm a past member of Mensa. I left it not because Mensa is not an organization worthy of, you know, hanging out with other bright people, but simply because I didn't have the time after I created my solo law practice to attend their meetings. I don't know precisely what my IQ is, but I was told by somebody at CIA that it was 168. It was definitely 140 because I was identified as a mentally gifted minor in the state of California. But I was told by somebody at CIA, a senior career case officer at CIA, that she had seen in my file that my IQ was listed at 168, which is
kind of
high.
Do you have any last word, any websites you want to give out to our listeners before we close this show up?
Yeah, I'd like to draw your listeners to my campaign website, which is andy2016.com. And also that if you're interested in time travel, for 7 years on a daily basis, I've been maintaining Project Pegasus on Facebook. It's the top one you'll find when you search the term Project Pegasus on Facebook. And I just want to say that the old politics is dying, and that's indicated by the fact that nobody's excited. In fact, people are really expressing a lack of faith and support and hostility towards Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. So the old politics is dying, and I may not win the presidency this time around, but I would really urge your listeners to follow my campaign in 2020 because I am not giving up. I'm going to continue to seek the presidency to restore us to the high level of honesty, reform, and creativity that is the legacy that we inherited from our ancestors as Americans.
This is the closing of our show. I want to thank the listeners for tuning in to The People Speak. A big thanks to Andy. Andy, thank you for being here tonight and sharing with us. Our engineer, Don Newsom, producer, Mike Kim. Thank you all. Let us unite through love and light. Good night, and be good to one another. Thank you.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.